Hey, this is Mike from the High Hash Rate Podcast. Before we get started, I just want to do a brief shout out to a partnership of ours, the Freedom Festival 2024 in the heart of New England on May 4th. Participate in a unique celebration where the pursuit of freedom, health, and community values come together through engaging activities and inspiring experiences. Immerse yourself in all things Bitcoin. That's right, including Bitcoin speakers, Bitcoin music, Texas Slim's Cattleman's Feast Barbecue, Bitcoin workshops, and etc. Participate in interactive demonstrations like parkour, cold plunge, wow, that sounds fun, hot tub, a soccer contest, and a raffle with prizes. Buy your tickets today. You can enter our affiliate link, HighRate20, for a 20% discount. You could also visit, for more information, massadoption.net. Anyway, on to our show.
Screw it. Here we go.
I gotta go buy Nikes. He's grown out of them every 6 months. And, you know, little girls gotta wear diapers. It's out of hand. And you're just trying to keep up. Like, that's the problem, I think, in the economy right now. There are a lot of people who, you know, went through the plan. And, you know, I spent my whole life learning about money. But I'm doing corporate accounting 60 hours a week, and I got to come home and now manage my money.
Hey, everybody. This is the High Hash Rate Podcast. I'm Mike.
And I'm Dan.
And this podcast is just two plebs getting high and talking about Bitcoin, life, and the absurdity of the fiat world. Our guests don't necessarily get high with us, and you don't have to either.
But it helps.
Welcome back to High Hash Rate. Today we're talking with Cedric Youngelman. Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Cedric's from the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. We've had him scheduled to come on to High Hash Rate for months now. Due to miscommunications, to timing, schedule conflicts, it's been a tough one, but we finally got him on. So, hey man, super excited to have you on the show.
This is great. It's definitely been a long time in the making, and I've been, you know, watching you guys and hearing you guys, and I'm excited to get into it, you know.
Awesome.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember or not, but we both met in person. We even shared an Uber ride at Big Block Boom 2 years ago. But as it goes with conferences and things like that, sometimes it's like, oh, shit, like, that's a person who I know. It's like a celebrity almost in my world. And you get kind of, you just introduce yourself and you just make small talk. But we've definitely met before, but this is going to be our first, like, Bitcoin conversation, like, things where we get into deeper topics, yeah.
Yeah, well, you definitely look familiar. I kind of remember that. I can't say I definitely do, but it's kind of coming back now. It's like almost like that's like 8 years ago in Bitcoin.
Oh, exactly. Right. It goes so fast, and you go to so many conferences and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I don't go to too many conferences, but, you know, they are a blur. And they're a lot of fun, and they could be a little much for someone like me, maybe, who can be extroverted by choice, but maybe introverted by nature, and can find
for
those
sure.
things a little bit overwhelming, you know, but they are great experiences. I was just at Bitcoin Day Naples, and, you know, at a time in my life, and I love going to the conferences, especially the smaller ones, and BitBlock Boom is very special.
For sure. Yeah. I definitely relate to that with the introvert extrovert balance. I think that personally, I am just one of those people who, similar to the introvert by nature, I'm not great with like the small talk and the introductions and kind of just like that situation when you meet people for the first time in person. But I really like to when you get into the deeper conversation. And I think that's really what sparked Mike and I mean, that's how our relationship started when we first met in El Salvador. And so I think that kind of sparks one of the reasons we wanted to do our podcast. But speaking of podcasts, you're also a podcaster and, you know, a pretty respected one. I've listened to many of your episodes. You've spoken with everybody, it seems like. Maybe just a high level, talk about your podcast and like when you started that.
Sure. I started the podcast in September 28th of 2020 was my first interview with Pierre. And about a week before that, I drunk DM'd him on a Saturday night, like at midnight, and like 8 o'clock in the morning, he was like, yeah, I'll do it. How about Wednesday morning? And I was like, oh, fuck. Now I got to put a whole show together. I mean, I need like music. I need like more than one guest, probably. I need a microphone. I went out and got a producer to start. I texted Pierre back, can we do this on a Saturday? I mean, I wasn't going to be ready by Wednesday and take a day off from work. And so, yeah, I started it a little over 3 years ago. What I think of as sort of the peak of COVID, or as the, you know, that arc was going. And there were just so many reasons for me personally to start a podcast in that time, was just, you know, being at home a little bit more with no commute and things like that. So,
yeah. So you said you drunk DM'd Pierre one night. So it sounds like something like you had been thinking about doing this for a while, and you hadn't pulled the trigger. I mean, so it sounds like you got your first guest before you had your the name, your setup, your microphone, anything.
So I was kind of lucky with Pierre, but yeah, I've been thinking about doing a pod for a long time. I'd always wanted to do content creation. I do corporate accounting consulting by day. I sell my fiat job. But I took a break about 25 years ago, and I went to film school, and I was in television production for about 2 or 3 years. I was thinking about it, and I'd always gotten podcasting became sort of my medium of choice for just entertainment and knowledge seeking. I'd fallen in love with a podcast that wasn't a Bitcoin podcast, and I was really enjoying the medium. And, you know, you'd be at barbecues or something, and people would say, oh, you know, you should have a podcast. And usually that was sort of me being on a soapbox, probably lecturing someone on Bitcoin or something, or politics. But that's not what I wanted. I didn't want to be on a soapbox every week. I didn't want to just yell at people. And without Bitcoin, you know, certain things weren't in place where I didn't have a subject that I felt I could explore indefinitely. And without Bitcoin, or, you know, something like my favorite podcast was Mark WTF, What the Fuck with Mark Maron. And he, you know, is a famous comedian. He interviews other famous people. And part of that is that they're, you know, he's interviewing, talking to famous people that are interesting. And it wasn't until it dawned on me with Bitcoin that I had built up enough knowledge, or felt that I was, at that time, I felt like, oh, I could take a chance on this. I didn't feel like I had all the knowledge, and I still don't. But I was like, wow, I can get in touch with someone like Pierre Richard. And it was because a year before that, there was an accounting job that, you know, Kraken had posted for, and I sent him my resume, and he actually took the time to respond. So we had a line of communication. It wasn't like a deep or strong one. But Bitcoiners are kind of courageous and generous. He was willing to come on my show. He never met me before. He didn't know what kind of questions, what the show was going to be about. And a lot of Bitcoiners said they'd come on the show before I even put out any material. You know, and it was around that time that I went from, I was De La Sed. My favorite hip hop group was De La Soul. So my moniker was De La Sed, and I had a NIM, and I didn't have a picture. And I kind of thought, you know, it'd just be a lot maybe easier and copacetic to book guests if I took the NIM down and brought out, you know, put my face up. But there were just a lot of reasons, and we could get into it, why I wanted to start a pod that was beyond Bitcoin. It was just, you know, that was COVID. I wanted to do something entrepreneurial from home. I wanted to protect my Bitcoin time, like listening to other pods and reading articles. And I lost the commute and sort of my lunch break at work, and I was home all day. And, you know, yeah, there were just lots of reasons. I turned my wife into a Bitcoiner. So she was listening to What Bitcoin Did with McCormick every day when I'd come home from work. So I was like, hey, you know, maybe if I do a podcast, you'd listen to me instead of him. And, you know, Peter has a great show, but, you know, there were just lots of reasons. I wanted to show my kids the technology behind podcasting or communications. Like I said, I always wanted to do content creation. I always wanted to do something that was completely my own, that I started from scratch and I just controlled it completely. And I even just, I like I said earlier, I worked with a producer, and that was sort of just me being naive. I didn't really need him, but, you know, he was sort of controlling the keys to my show. And there was a moment, you know, 6 weeks in where I was like, if you don't give me the keys to my show, like, I'm not even going to do this. It was very much not your keys, not your show, you know? And I was like, I'm not going to build this thing and share it with you, or give up, you know, 100% sovereignty over it. So there was just lots of reasons to start the show back then. And
I definitely want to get in and talk more about your show, because I have quite a few questions, actually.
But sure.
Before we do, I just kind of wanted to get into your background a little bit. You mentioned you were in corporate accounting.
Still,
and you mentioned and you mentioned going to film school. Can you just kind of fill in some of the gaps there, and like how you got to what your education background and what your pursuits were up until this?
Sure.
Point?
Yeah. So I have a Bachelor's of Science in Finance and a Master's of Science in Accountancy that EY, or what was Ernst & Young, put me and paid for me to go to University of Virginia, get my Master's of Science in Accounting. And I went on to work with Ernst & Young after that. And I went from New York to San Francisco with them. So I was like deep into Wall Street and sort of high finance in New York and big companies. And then San Francisco was more technology, communications, and energy companies and very different culture. And when I was wrapping up my commitment to EY, I was just trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I didn't necessarily want to continue on with accounting at that point. I really wanted to explore content creation. And I decided to first spend 3 months traveling the world by myself in the South Pacific. And then I went to New York Film Academy for 10 weeks when I returned. And when I was done, I went to my home city of New York City. And when I was done with that, I moved in with my folks and I started making, you know, while working as a PA in television and commercials and whatnot. And I just kept falling back into finance and accounting, helping all these people. And
sure,
it was where I was most valuable. And I became a controller of a reality television company in New York City. And after falling out with them, we moved to Chicago and I just got back into pure corporate accounting consulting. And
the fun stuff. Sort of,
How was that? Yeah. The Film Academy. I hear that their marketing is so good.
Hey, but Mike, where did you go again? Where did you go to film school?
I went to Purchase, SUNY Purchase.
Oh, that's a fantastic program.
It's a very good program. I mean,
my cousin is a fine arts professor. I think there.
Who's your cousin?
Rick.
Oh, yeah, okay.
No, I don't forget his last name even. Oh, man, it's been a long time. It'll come to me in a second, but...
How was that program, the New York Film Academy?
You know, so they have all different kinds of permutations that you can take and modules and sort of you can kind of... It's like cafeteria style, and it's really evolved even since then, since I went. But it's... What it boils down to a lot of things, it's what you make of it. You know, it's a lot like my shitcoin career. When I was learning about Bitcoin, you know, I lost a bunch of money, but I learned a lot. And, you know, New York Film Academy, in its essence, is a rental program. You're getting access, generally speaking, to the equipment. You go out and make friends with the other dumb fucks in your class. I mean, you know, there's some good professors, some bad professors. You're going to have some nice conversations. You're going to meet some interesting people, maybe build a network. But, you know, in my program, I had 10 weeks and we had different tracks. And, you know, at the end of 10 weeks, I had four films. You know, one was like a short, one was an experimental, and two were like the first one we put out and like they were whatever, you know. So what you come up with in 10 weeks, you know, how much you're going to improve, what is your reel going to look like, you know, that's really up to you. The talent you come into that, the work you put into it, maybe some luck and perspiration. I think, you know, in terms of vocationally, maybe if you want to experience something, it's, you know, a great way to kind of expose yourself to that craft and see if you really want to continue or not. Is it a great ROI? Probably not for the general, you know, sort of public or whoever goes into it. And some famous kids have gone into it, you know, and some people have come out of it. But one of my best friends from college, she went there and she is one of the premier reality television production producers in the country. I don't think necessarily like that piece of it was, you know, the link in the puzzle that put everything together. But, you know, she was bartending in New York City, went there and then started PAing and rose through the ranks, you know.
You said you fell back into finance eventually, but did you spend much time pursuing filmmaking, or just what other content creation did you necessarily spend time producing? Well, so big projects or anything like that?
After New York Film Academy, I spent about maybe 2-3 years working as a PA, working as an editor's assistant, working in the trenches. I even interned at my favorite indie company of all time. They co-produced Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and 21 Grams and great films. And, you know, I learned a lot about myself throughout that experience. What my dream was to either be a director or a producer. And I think at 26 years old, I didn't have the life stories yet to be a real director, to share my stories on screen, you know. And I also learned that I didn't want to necessarily work for a year and a half or 2 years and collaborate with a bunch of people or be at, you know, sort of that whim. And also, quite honestly, like a lot of people, you know, Yeah, and the indie film is a lot of that's nepotism or sort of born rich. And then, you know, in the trenches of the film industry, you know, there's a lot more opportunity in reality television. And I saw a lot of my peers doing really well on that. And I just had no industry. No, and the exposure I got to that was disgusting. The reality television shows I went on to and what I saw them put people through, innocent or wannabe stars or whatnot, was just horrible. And there was a lot of money on the table there, and it's just not the direction I wanted to go. It's kind of like you have choices in life. Like I grew up, I wanted to be an investment banker until I found out that was really about when I was 22.
Sure.
You know, it's
we've talked about this before on the show, but Mike and I both, when we were in the Air Force at different times, we didn't know each other at the time. But we talked about in the past that our deployments and just our service, our experiences in the service kind of revealed how the sausage was made, so to speak. That it was kind of this, it exposed the reality of the world, the reality of war, the reality of politics and economics, everything compared to what you're seeing when you're watching the screen, right? So in your experience, working on sets, being exposed to reality TV, I think it's kind of a similar situation where you are seeing the real truth, the ugly reality that people on the other side of the screen just are not seeing.
Right.
And it's just, it just changes your perspective on a lot of things, I think, when you start from there.
There were things I definitely liked about it. And the things I like about it, I get to do now with my pod. And I get to create content every week and tell the stories that I want to tell. You know, the stars are the guests, but I get to, you know, produce that show and sort of direct it in the sense that I pick the topics or the questions or sort of how we're going to go about and address the episode. So I'm kind of fulfilling all those goals now, just in a different medium, and I have all the control I want. But yeah, there were one of the things I really love about film production or any content creation is that you're in that moment. It feels like sports. It's something I miss from being a kid, you know, or a young adult, like playing sports a lot more and being in the moment. And so corporate accounting, you know, could be interesting. Maybe you're working with large data sets or trend analysis, and most of it's not interesting, being a little honest. But when it is interesting, it's not live action, and when it is, it's not even real collaboration usually in the C-suite of a Fortune 500 company. It's a lot of everyone saying
it's all about
what they
the
need
past.
To say.
It's all about the past, right? You're just
it's all about the past.
Accounting for and recording, you know, data from behind you. Yeah.
Not
so getting, the present moment.
Right. So getting into just the nuts and bolts is kind of boring and looking at the past. And most of the things you have to say is usually scripted. You can't really go upstream or against the grain. It's just there's too much career risk, political capital at stake within these companies, or people just don't want to risk their seats. So
I'm curious, like, go ahead, Mike.
Can I just point out that I'm drawing a relationship here between your connection with filmmaking and the name of the podcast and this connection to reality television of like you and as you were saying, Dan, like the discovery of, you know, reality television, how hilarious it's called reality television.
But you got to look at the source code. You got to look at the accounting. Yeah. You got to look at the books. You got to see the
It's a constructed reality, you know. It's a false narrative, false reality.
Yeah.
And so what I'm curious about is the name of your podcast.
Well, it comes from The Matrix, Keanu Reeves, Neo, Morpheus. I at the time I sort of jokingly thought of Pierre Richard as my Morpheus on this journey, and I was glad he was my first guest. You know, and I think there's a lot of, it's sort of the reverse matrix where you're leaving the matrix when you enter the Bitcoin matrix, you know, and it has that sort of inverse play when you really break it down, maybe in that way. But I really do think that there's the fiat matrix control system and you could escape into the Bitcoin overlay.
For sure. And
yeah, with the show, I really wanted to be clear that it was a Bitcoin maxi show or Bitcoin focused show. I didn't want to really play around with that. And I wanted to just sort of interplay what I thought was just the most, I don't know how to put it, but like just kind of creating a setting, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Suggests this theme of just saying of like discovering some sort of truth. That's, you know what I mean?
And so the show is about truth seeking and sort of the philosophical implications of Bitcoin or societal, cultural, and economic implications.
Yeah. So that perfect leads up to, I was going to ask you,
you
your your Bitcoin story. Like, when did you step through the matrix, and when did you start going down that rabbit hole, and what was that experience like for you?
Sure. So I feel like it was the third touch that, you know, got me, but you don't remember the first two that well because you dismissed it, right? Or maybe some people have significant touches that they dismiss, but I feel like the first time I heard about Bitcoin was very early on, just for some reason. I just dismissed it as sort of like a baseball card collectible type thing, like a really cool little thing. And but not collectible in the sense that you can make money on it, just like this community had a way to interact with each other and get what they wanted, and they could have freedom. And that's just like a nice little sandbox for...
That's still a pretty insightful first touch. I don't think most people
like
came close to that.
I don't know. And maybe that's just me rewriting history. I have no idea.
Sure.
Then I feel like the next time I heard about it, probably... So I think that was around 2010-ish or 2011. But I don't feel like... Maybe I'm imagining it, but it was like 2013, I feel like I heard it again. And that's when I think I heard the number, the price. And so I think it like maybe hit 1,000 in 2013-ish or somewhere, you know. And then I was like, whoa, that's weird. That thing like that you could have bought for whatever, that just felt like you wouldn't buy it for the value of it. You bought it so that you could be in this system where you could exchange goods. That the whole point wasn't to get the money. It was to get the goods that you wanted. And I didn't have any issue getting any goods in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So now all of a sudden the thing you bought the goods with that, you know, that's something the problem with is now valuable. But now I'm like, wow, that's, you know, and I think this happens to a lot of people. It's like, that's more valuable than something I would consider buying now. Right? Like, that's expensive. Like, I don't know, I got $1,000. I gotta buy that. If I had $1,000, like, we'd take the family away for a vacation this weekend. You know, I've been nagging about, like, I'm not going to go spend it on this toy, you know, and go buy these other things that I don't need. Like, what's the, you know? And I still didn't think of it as like something that would go up more. It just sounded valuable, but it just sounded expensive and, you know, kind of like an iPhone. Like, yeah, I want one, but maybe the first time it came out, I didn't get it, you know? So then I heard about it. Well, so 2016, like the world goes crazy, you know, with the election, and I'm on Facebook and I'm just trying to like get better information, and Facebook is just nothing. It's horrible. And I end up on Twitter somehow, like, oh, there's people, and Twitter is like a fucking weird place to me at this point. Like, it's just chaos, and I don't understand how to be in this place. And I'm just hanging out on Twitter, like, you know, your first time you're on there, like a minute a day and whatever, and you just
right.
And yeah. I probably was on political Twitter and FinTwit. You know, I'm interested in finance, macro economics, that kind of thing, my whole life. So I think somehow Bitcoin Twitter just slipped into my feed, like people, like heavily armed clowns saying things about economics that were coming at it from the bit, you know, and people would say things just so, what felt like so obnoxious or so like know-it-all. And that's when I'm kind of like, well, you know, I got to look into that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that, not like I'm going to agree, like, oh, I want to kind of say something that's going to put a chink in this whole like Bitcoin that fixed the money, fixed the world. No, that's not right. Or whatever they're saying.
It's like we're antagonizing people. We're putting out extremely opinionated, very bold,
right,
and very absurd statements, right, and daring you to prove us wrong. And people come and they try to, like what you said, put chinks in your armor and try to tell you that your interpretation is just absurd. And the more they do that, the more they have to learn about it. And and sometimes they just start agreeing with you, and they start, and they're the ones posting it.
Yeah,
with you.
I wouldn't be like, I don't agree with that guy, but I can't prove him wrong.
Or how do I approach
and
this?
And the more things that, like, you know, people, Bitcoin's going to save the environment. Okay, how do they say, you know, and then you'd look into it and you'd be like, okay, I see stranded gas, and that makes sense. And that's a no brainer. So people would be saying things, and they'd cause, though, all these new. So once I got sort of, well, there's multiple levels to it. So there's, you know, now while this is happening, the price of Bitcoin is moving at a crazy pace. So this is probably happening somewhere in June, July, August that I'm hearing about Bitcoin. And somewhere between August, September, October, I'm like looking at the price a lot. That's all I remember. Again, you don't remember when you start looking at something, maybe.
Right. Right.
But somewhere in like October, I got this idea, like, this could change my family's life in some way. And I believe that the first couple sats can change your life in just giving you freedom of mind and sovereignty and understanding these different things and feeling more in control of your own destiny and taking responsibility for yourself, all these different things. And if you're already primed for that stuff, and like now you have a tool that's going to help you get there even faster. But I was like, wow, like this is like from a speculative stand, and I'm not a speculative person by nature in terms of, I'm not speculating everywhere. I have nothing speculative going.
Right.
And I'm just looking at it saying, I'm like, I don't know, like, feels like something like I should just, I can't refute anything they're saying. They're just saying it's so big and the total addressable market and, you know, and everything. You are,
and you've got the background, the education, the professional experience to have a sober and mature kind of perspective here.
Yeah, I know like enough you're to just really
attracted
hurt myself
by the memes, right?
I know really a lot to just get a lot of trouble now. Like, because, you know, this is all traditional finance. So like, think about it, like my first time, you know.
But you also probably didn't need to be, you probably didn't need this. This probably isn't your lotto ticket to richness. I mean, you probably, seems like you've got a good career, you invest money. This
isn't
like.
That's the problem. I got a good career and I'm still, you know, inflation is still kicking my ass every day.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I got my second kid, you know, like I got another mouth to feed and, you know, we just bought a house and now I didn't. 2 years ago, I didn't have camp. And now the oldest one wants to go to camp. And now that I just somehow managed to pay for camp, the next year camp went up 12%.
Okay. Right? Like, you're saving.
I got a 3.75 raise. I'm kicking ass in fiat land. And
yeah.
I'm getting killed
and,
by camp.
And your savings at that time is going to yield you 0%.
Right. And I got to go buy Nikes. He's growing out of them every 6 months. And, you know, little girls got to wear diapers. It's out of hand. And you're just trying to keep up. Like, that's the problem, I think, in the economy right now. There are a lot of people who, you know, went through the plan. And, you know, I spent my whole life learning about money. But I'm doing corporate accounting 60 hours a week. And I got to come home and now manage my money.
And this guy, heavily armed clowned, and these other dudes are telling you, like, yeah, you're stupid if you're doing this. We have money. We're rich over here. Our savings.
I'm coming home. I'm like, babe, like, you don't know what heavily armed clown said today. He told me that, like, if I don't get off zero, I'm a fucking dick. And, like, that the Fed is going to destroy me by Monday. And I got to look into this, you know? And I think he's right. And it was such an honor to talk to Hack, Gus. What?
How are those early conversations with your wife about?
I'm lucky. I mean,
space.
They go like any conversation. We have a great relationship, and you know, but there, you know, I guess you know, a lot of it's not easy. I mean, it's, I think we have it maybe easier than most because we have a great relationship. But like these, you know, hard things like how are you going to spend your money? What is important to you? What do you value? Why can't I just get everything that we need and define need versus want? And like, this is all part of like life, and that's not easy for anybody to figure these things out. You know, and compromise and but when the pie is like the denominator is like increasing on you rapidly, right? So it's like you're figuring things out every year, and every year you're doing calculations, and there's so many calculations to make, right? You know, it's like your personal statement of cash flows, your balance sheet, your income statement, you got multiple spenders, you got cost centers up to wazoo, you have limited profit centers maybe. I mean, some people have more profit centers than other. Yeah, I remember one of my coworkers, he would talk about his wife going to college, you know, going to school before, you know, he's like, she's a cost center right now, you know, like doesn't make any money. I mean, these are accounting terms, but, you know, and yeah, you're trying to figure these things out, but like I'm busting my ass. It's never good enough because the money's broken. Right. Like, you know, I go to pick up food and like now it's $30 for a family of four to eat dinner. The food didn't get, I can get more food. It's not getting hotter. It's not staying hotter in the bag. It's doesn't taste any better. And then money's so broken now that the people working in the restaurants can't even buy the food that they're serving. I mean, even at a fast food restaurant, like Big Mac's like $15. So it's like they hate serving people because it's not. They're losing money by showing up to work is really how it goes.
You bring up a really good, interesting point that I think about constantly is like, are they like the people that aren't into Bitcoin? I look at like, how does anyone survive? How's anyone doing it out there?
I don't, you know, I ask that question almost every show, especially the economic minded guys I talk to. And, you know, you have the wider spectrum here from Dave Collum, doom and gloom, and Lawrence Lepard to, you know, what is it, Mike Alfred and Joe Calasari is like, look at all the other economic metrics that are booming.
Right.
It's hard to read because the dominant is fucked up. But
what you see on the screen is not reality. These numbers, just like the show, the television show.
The restaurants are full. The breweries are full. The movie theaters are full. The vacation spots are full. Like everywhere you go. And maybe people
somebody's
playing
doing
games.
Well.
Maybe it's the hotels are full because of the migrants. And maybe the restaurants are full because there's a few less of them now. I it's really hard to keep up. But like, it doesn't feel like a ghost town anywhere I go. And I'm trying to go as many different places I go and get out of my bubble. And I'm not saying I do that a lot, but I once in a while I fly to a different city and I get in a rental car and I drive an hour and a half to get somewhere. You know, I mean, things still look pretty normal everywhere. And everyone just, I don't know if everyone's working a second job. Like, I'm working three jobs. Like, you know, I do the pod after work. I could probably get make more money Ubering, but like I do the pod after work. I do the Bitcoin advisor. I do my regular job. You know, I mean,
we're all talking about a time span when you're getting orange pilled, right? This is 2020, just to.
Yeah.
Okay. Ripe for change there. But so you're getting orange pilled and then boom, in October, right? As which I remember.
I wouldn't say I'm getting orange pilled. I'm just like, this thing is like running. These guys are yapping. This is exciting. Like I gotta take a.
So you,
I want to put some skin in the game. The crazy part is like just watching my ACH, you know, waiting for my ACH to go from my bank to Coinbase cost me like half a Bitcoin, you know, and so like now like I don't have enough to buy a whole Bitcoin when my ACH showed up at Coinbase, and fuck man, I was like looking at Brian. I'm still pissed. So like you know, ETH and Litecoin, they're positioned next to this thing. And I'm thinking about this from all different perspectives. I'm not thinking about it from the monetary policy standpoint at 21 million. I'm speculating on the technology in my mind at this point. This blockchain thing is solving money. It's not the monetary policy that's solving money. It's the blockchain. I mean, I don't know what that is, right? And these other things got blockchain in them and they're going to solve other things. And the unit price bias comes into this. And then traditional legacy portfolio diversification, right? And all these things fall into play. And now I got a whole fucking bag of all these things. And over the next 7 weeks, they all run from November 2nd to Christmas. And the other, the ETH and the Litecoin run way higher, percentage-wise, ratio-wise, unit price bias, whatever. I'm doing better on those. I'm like, oh man, I could have got more of those. And then, you know, a few weeks later, it all crashes, or a few months later, whatever you want to call it, it's all gone. And now, like, I'm like, what do I got? Like, what is this? And do I still believe in this thing? And is it still the thing that I thought it was, or was I a fool? So either I got to put in the work to find out, like, am I a fool? And I just clear out my 10% that I got left on the dollar left, right? Whatever it is. Or, like, was I still on to something and, like, everything I was learning about the cycles and we were at the end of this cycle and the halving and we're just going to play it again. And I got to get some more of this while I wait for that to happen.
And
it's on me now, right? I got to put in more work.
And as you're doing this, you're having regular conversations with the likes of Lynn Alden, Jeff Booth.
You're
not there yet.
A year and a half, 2 years before the show.
Okay. Okay.
This is still way before the show. This is like months into the journey.
Okay.
I'm building shitcoin mining machines with my best friend. I'm reading white papers, you know, and I'm trying to figure this out. And it was oddly enough, I was on a shitcoin group in Facebook, and because I'm going I'm back on Facebook looking for some information, right? And how much of my portfolio will be a Bitcoin and how much should be ETH and Bcash, and someone was like, look buddy, like I'm not gonna tell you what to do, but you're in like every horse in this race is a proof of work horse. This is when ETH was still proof of work. And he's like, why don't you try to figure out which is your favorite horse, like which horse do you think is gonna win, like instead of just betting on all the horses in the fucking race. Like, and that was an interesting point. Like he was like, what differentiates these things? differentiates these things, and which do I like the most and why? And why wouldn't I concentrate on that? Which, you know, propelled me further on my journey. You know, and it wasn't until, not I was going to say, but along that journey, you know, Vijay Boyapati's most bullish case for Bitcoin, Bitcoin Standard by Safe, What Bitcoin Did by McCormick, Pod, and, you know, Stefan Levera and Marty Bent, Tales from the Crypt, and then guest hopping, you know, finding, you know, Pierre Richard wherever he is, and Bitcoin Tina and American HODL, and going through that journey of the deep, dark, bear market of, you know, I now have conviction. I sold all my shit coins. I cleared all that out. The worst trade of my life was selling my last shit coin that I knew would boom after I sold it, but I just wanted to sleep better at night. Ethics, morals, whatever. You know, different things, different strokes for different folks. But
what was that light bulb moment?
That was a school. And then, yeah.
What was that? Was the moment that you were you just realized I had to get out of all this other stuff?
I mean, I think the moment that I just was like, Bitcoin was like a once in a species opportunity, was like kind of like cutting out of work, listening to like Bitcoin Tina, like wherever it was, and just it was like a particular Bitcoin Tina podcast. I was like, or maybe the Must Stop Murad pod on Palm. If you can skip all the shitcoin commercials in the beginning, that episode is just phenomenal. And Murad came on my show and we did our attempt to do it. And he's a little further on his shitcoin journey than I appreciate, but the material still stands. That episode is incredible. And I was just like, this changes everything. I went outside. It's kind of like, I remember I had a friend die at a very early age. And, you know, just sitting in like, I don't think it was Irving Park, but Gramercy Park in New York City. It's like everything, just like nothing mattered. You know, it's like all the sounds around you, they're just like, they don't matter. And like the world just feels like, you know, you see the one leaf just floating. And that was like the Bitcoin moment. Was like, and I was like looking at like, no, like, you know, everyone's just going to CVS or like going in their house or driving their car. I'm like, people don't know. They don't know. And you're going to have to wait. Like, and I'm going to have to wait 4 years to prove this, you know, or like, and it's just like really quiet, eerie. And you're like, I'm going to go back to work. I'm gonna go sit in that cubicle and pretend I didn't have this moment,
right? You know, it's almost like you feel like if you were going back in time to leave clues for people, like how would you do it? How would you like introduce it? It's almost like before the halving, before the bull market. It's like, how do I leave clues or like help people realize that I'm right a few months from now, and then they'll, you know, it'll click for them.
I don't know. I would not be what I was those first 2 years, screaming like a maniac at everyone I loved that they should figure this thing out and join me. And what part of that would, I would just be like, if I'm right, like if I'm 1% right, you owe it to yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
To get on this journey. And if I'm wrong, like, and if you have any love for me, then you owe it to me to like figure out how I'm crazy, like help me get out of this crazy.
Did you proselytize to your like coworkers and stuff, or like
what's too much?
So all your coworkers,
and I tried not
now.
To, but okay.
So yeah, your coworkers knew, like they
not like, oh, I mean like a few, or like, you know, whatever. I'd pick my moments.
Sure.
I became, you know, and then I'm a consultant, so like 3 months later I'm in another gig. Like,
sure.
You know, I see those people sometimes once a year, or I see someone every day for 6 months. Or like right now I've been remote for 4 years, so like I haven't told anyone I work about anything in 3 years. You know, this wouldn't come up on a conference call. I try to never tell them in Florida. They'd just be jealous. Or all,
yeah, right. So it's not like, oh, it's like, it's Cedric's coming in and it's like, that's the guy with the Bitcoin podcast.
No, not now.
Yeah,
then
okay.
Maybe, you know, and even with family, like I had to move. I'm like, I can't talk to you guys about it anymore. This is crazy. I'm going to start a podcast because like I wanted to have long form conversations about Bitcoin, but also with someone who cared, but also maybe people who knew more about it, me. And I, at that time,
right.
Like, you know, and I was tired of people not being interested, or like literally telling me everything you said sounds like so right, so smart, but I'm just, yeah, I'm not going to put in the work.
Right.
I think a lot of it is like, and I learned this from Bitcoin Tina, like people don't trade with their future selves. They trade with their prior selves and they trade against you. So like anyone you're telling about Bitcoin, generally speaking, they're like, I've known Danny since he's a little boy. Danny did not find the next world's global reserve currency.
Right.
Before MSNBC is going to tell me about it. He's been talking about it for a long time. So he probably got his for a nickel. He's probably got 18,000 of them and he wants to be able to buy his bags. And all I want to do is root against this Bitcoin thing.
Yeah.
Because even if I get on board, how much am I in for? I'm not going to, but this is now $66,000. And no one thinks about reallocation or like moving out of what they have. It's precious to them what they've already bought, even if they didn't pick it out in their 401k. And they're like, I don't got new money. No one's got that kind of money laying around.
Yeah, nobody's ready to part with their target
and
retirement date, 2050.
Yeah, whatever the price is.
Yeah.
It's too much. And they don't trust it. So if anything, if they're going to get involved in anything at all, they're going to go gamble nihilistically somewhere else against you. I'm going to find my own Bitcoin. I'm going to show Danny. He's not the only one. And it just becomes, how much do I think Danny's got on this thing? Because they look at you. They think about how much you think you've been making. How much how long you've been talking about it, what the price was when you started. They try to calculate what they think you got. And they're like, I'm never going to get there. And I hope that goes to zero and I get my own lottery ticket somewhere else. I'm going on Robinhood and buying NVIDIA. Danny, I'm getting GME.
That's a good point.
It's true. And it's just so like, or your younger brother, like my older brothers will never buy Bitcoin because it's, my younger brother told me about it. Like, how right could he be? Or, they're smarter than me. They're older than me. Like, they got their own plans.
Right. It's hard to give financial advice to somebody when you sold your Honda Accord at the top last cycle to buy more Bitcoin right before it crashed. You don't have any chairs in your house and your underwear and your socks have holes because you're saving so much money to stack so many sats.
Yeah.
And you tell somebody, like, you got to buy this. You got to sell your NVIDIA stock, your Berkshire Hathaway, your gold, whatever, and buy this. And they're like, all right, man, like, chill out.
Because they think of it, like, honestly, as like the NVIDIA money was like, well, that's my savings. That's
right.
And that came right out of my paycheck. But this Bitcoin thing, it's Bitcoin or a Mercedes? It's Bitcoin or a new indoor pool, in-ground pool for the kids? I mean, how many times have you heard the story about the coworker that's been orange-pilled? Someone's been orange-pilling them for 6 months. And, they get an 80 grand inheritance when someone passes away and they go out and get the in-ground pool and the Mercedes. And a year later, Bitcoin booms and they're like, and they were like about to do it then, but they're like, well, if I do it, then I don't have access to it and I don't get to enjoy it. And if it goes down, everyone's going to laugh at me.
For sure.
I followed stupid Danny's advice or stupid Mikey's advice. And, now I'm the bigger idiot, because he bought his at a nickel and it's really hard. And if you can even do the thing where like, you're like, hey, why don't I give you $10 a Bitcoin? And I'll send it to you and you'll see. And you'll be, now you just said the most valuable thing in the world is free. Yeah. You got another, it's gave it for free. You just devalued it. I just gave it to you for free.
I just put it on the wall of Satoshi. Who cares?
Use it
if you're a member in the future.
Yeah, it's very difficult. And like, so the best way, I think two ways, and this all took years of time, and you still got to, and you got to remember, if someone asks you about Bitcoin, even if they ask you, like, how much time do you have with them? Cause you got a minute with them? Like, how much time they really, you got the elevator pitch, you got 5 minutes with them? At best, you're generally speaking an hour of uninterrupted time with someone. Then they'll be exhausted, right?
Oh, yeah.
I like Parker Lewis's advice, like, just do Mike Tyson body punch. No, don't do Mike Tyson knockout. Just do body punches and just pick one point, 21 million, 21 million, 21, 21 million. But the other things I do is I say, you're probably not ready for it yet. I walk away. And I just let it go with that. Like, it's just not on me to, like, explain it to you. And, like, maybe reverse psychology is interesting. And then the real way, and that's sarcastic, but it's true. But the real way is if you know someone or they let you know what their pain point is. And if you can tackle
that's something
that
I've discovered as well, yeah, for sure.
But
trying,
like,
to figure that out.
And I like, I'm at the point where I'm forgetting some guests' names. But one guest was like, he was really cool about it. He's like, you just gotta be cool. Just let them know Bitcoin's cool. Don't get into this whole like, you need to buy Bitcoin. Bitcoin's gonna change your world. Bitcoin's a moonshot. Bitcoin is really cool. Like, you might like cool things. You should look at it. It's really cool. Like, the internet is really cool.
Yeah, that's Corey Clipson's thing. You know, Bitcoin is cool. He's trying to make Bitcoin cool.
Yeah, Bitcoin's cool. Like, why not? And just let it be at that. You know, but some people might get it like where you explain it where like, you know, remember when, like if I was telling my mom about it, like my mom always, she kind of gets like trends early. Like she was interested in computing in like 1984. Like she was a public school teacher and she got the school to let her buy a computer with their money and bring it home. And I had a computer, I was like 6 years old, you know, and she didn't do much with it, but like files, do some Word documents, whatever. But like, she was always, you know, kind of into that. And we had AOL in 1994, right? And so like, I would say to my mom something like, you know, 1994, if I told you this internet thing was going to be like really big, in 1994, you would have looked at me like you're crazy, like, or really big for like young people or not for me. And look at where it is now. The difference is you could actually buy a piece of this thing. But you're still asking the person, in effect, to trust you, the messenger, right? And you can go back to the thing, like, if I'm directionally right 1 or 10%, like, I think this thing's going to be worth $1 trillion of Bitcoin, and I'm directionally right, you're still looking at 100x from here at 1% of my correct direction, you know? And so you even if I'm just partially right, and you know, a lot of times people say, oh, you're a smart guy or you're the smartest guy. No, it's like, but you still ask, it's still, that's trust.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And it's like, if somebody asks you what the internet's today, it's kind of easy. You can say, well, it's Google, it's Apple, and it's
right.
Amazon, and it's all these things. It's all these applications, all these use cases that everybody uses every single day. But if you ask somebody back then, it's like, well, it's these networks of computers, and they talk to the other networks of computers, and they send packets of information back and forth. And it's like, yeah, well, that's Google, that's Amazon, like,
right,
that's everything.
Right,
and it's trying to explain Bitcoin today. It's like a network of computers, and they've got
right.
the ledger and the money, and you send it, and it verifies it, and it's the blockchain. But it's like, are you trying to fill in, paint that picture of the future of what this is really going to be, what this is really going to enable, and kind of almost making a meme out of it? Like, that's kind of what we're doing, right, on Twitter and stuff. We're memeing these different possibilities.
With landmines, like you could be it's digital gold. And if you don't know, they're like, I hate gold.
Oh, they hate it.
No, it's not digital gold, bro.
Digital energy. There's no such thing.
Right. And the person's like, well, I think the world's using too much energy. And you're like, okay, so it's not digital energy. Like, if you don't know the person. And,
right.
And so now you're back to like, how much guesswork can you do? How much you're going to put in to figure out who they are and what makes them tick? And how much they trust you or receive or think that you are signal? Right. Like a lot, because a lot of people, like, even if they, like, I've had people, like, I'm background in finance, accounting. I've had people come up to be like, my cousin's having money issues and we're looking at blah, blah. Do you think they should do X, Y, and Z? And I'll be like, well, I think they should do A, B, and C. And they'll be like, oh, no. Wait, you know, we're going to go talk to someone else
who's going to confirm what we want.
Right.
Confirm our biases. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you run into a lot of that too. And it's just, you know, because if you say black, they say white. Especially
for sure.
A lot of these things. Like, especially if you bring up money in a lot of conversations, it becomes very political. And people think you're right or left when most Bitcoiners are neither. So if you bring up money and someone leans left, they might think that you're very right.
Sure.
And then you don't know what kind of triggers people have. And then even going preceding all this, like, no matter what I thought about money, it was very rare that I went to where I come from. And I don't mean geographically, but how I was raised. You don't talk about money. Like, you don't go up to people, how much do you make? How do you spend your money? Because, like, when you say, like, you should buy something, that implies so much. Like, how much cash flow do they have? How much savings do they have? Like, what
risk
profile?
How can they handle volatility? Yeah.
Yeah, like, all these things. Like, I try to tell them never, but they'll do anything. I think Bitcoin is one of these things where, like, you can't go wrong suggesting Bitcoin to someone. It's like this tool that has, like, ubiquitous, like, benefits to people, like, and humanity. But I also feel like Bitcoin is going to benefit people who don't get on a Bitcoin standard.
Right.
It's just going to make the world a better place. And
agreed.
They'll benefit. And, like, it becomes tiresome to, like, that's the other thing, too. So people, when they're listening to you, if they're grokking all of it. They're like, or even if they're not, but they're glazing over and they're like, all Bitcoin's going to the moon and it's going to kill the Fed. And they're like, if I agree with hanging it like this and I'm going to sound like this person, And I don't, and I'm going to sound like I'm in a cult, and I'm going to go around evangelizing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be like this person. And you can see it. There's that moment where, like, you go from, like, the person, like, thinks you're cool, thinks you're smart, thinks you know what you're talking to, like, I don't know, man. Like, this is getting a little weird. Like, I just want to, you know, go back to my 5% of my money market,
right,
and call it a day. This is a little crazy. And the volatility. And
that's crazy, man. Did you catch the game last night?
Yeah, you know? And that's what, and you're like, oh. And then the other one is like, isn't it volatile? And I love that one. It's like, you know, like, as if net positive volatility, you know, was ever a bad thing. But, like, if you look at something like Amazon, and that's another one I'll throw at people. Like, Amazon has crashed over 90% three times, maybe four. Specifically in, like, in 2000, or they went,
right,
from, like, $100 to $6. So imagine you were the motherfucker who put $10,000 in this thing at,
right,
when it was at 100. You bought 10 shares, and now it's worth $60. You know, and only Jeff and his parents held through all three of those. And Jeff's parents only held on because they loved Jeff. Right? And so Jeff,
right,
held on because he understood what he had, the way Michael Saylor had understood inflation in a way most people can't grok, because he had a $500 million melting ice cube. So it's like, when you have a $500 melting ice cube, like, it's just not, you know, like, and you don't see your 401k as a melting ice cube, maybe. Right. So people, you're just in, you're the frog in the water kind of thing. Right. But, like, when you have that $500 million melting ice cube, and you go through that conversation where you figure out, like, Bitcoin is the best way to store the reserves for your company. And then your shareholders say to you, then if you're going to buy $500 million of magic internet money, why don't you just give it back to me? And he goes, well, I can't just give it back to you because we have reserves for a reason. Like, I have commitments to our clients that we're going to run these products and this software, and we're going to pay the electric bill. So I have to have reserves. So either you're in or you're out. But he's looking at that problem in a very different way.
Sure.
Because now, he happens to be a rocket scientist. I'm not trying to take anything away from him. That's where, you know, when I go back to those examples, like, I love these people who, like, study Bitcoin when they can't even put any money into Bitcoin, because those random events that when money does come their way.
Right.
Then they're like, okay, now I can actually act.
Yeah. There
have been so many people in my life who have dismissed Bitcoin because at that moment, their mind, they said, I can't buy Bitcoin today, and therefore I'm not going to put in the work. And then when that moment arrives, it never even dawns on them to buy Bitcoin.
Right.
Right? Because and this is where thinking in Bitcoin is the whole thing. Because when you're thinking in Bitcoin, when those opportunities come your way, you're like, of course, like, I would take a 100K payout instead of $4,000 a month for the rest of my life, 20
years
from now.
Exactly. Like, yes, exactly.
Right? But if you're in that fiat mindset, you're like, there's no, like, $4,000 a month for the rest of my life is way more than $100,000 today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But
right,
you're not thinking about purchasing power and the time value of
it
money.
It changes
and
how you make all your the most important decisions in your life. It changes,
right,
so, how you approach those.
Right. So I find, like, again, like, going back to, like, you, those first few sats change so much for you. It changes if you're getting on that level. I'm not saying the first few sats everyone gets on, but I'm saying it can. And you're like, okay, now I can control my money. No one could debase this thing. And I can control my desk. I have more control of my outcomes.
Yes. The last question that I really had for you is, I'm curious if you have any reflections or what you think has been the most impactful experience, because you have had, if I look at your roster of everybody you've interviewed, I mean, I 99% of them, I can think of multiple times where a conversation or a podcast interview that I've listened to them has sparked curiosity in my mind, sent me down a new rabbit hole, or sent me looking up more information about Bitcoin. It just changed the way my whole worldview, ultimately, in some cases. But I'm listening to those, and you're having the opportunity to direct these conversations and ask these respected, very intelligent people the questions that you want to ask from the perspective that you're coming from. And, like, that opportunity it's pretty special. So I'm just wondering how that's impacted you.
Wow, in so many ways, I guess. I get to enjoy the conversations, I guess. You know, in terms of learning on the show, there's a weird paradox where some of the shows I love to put in the research and prepare for the show. So I kind of know the answers maybe beforehand. So what's ultimately been very exciting of the show is where we get into areas where I'm less familiar with the answers. And there was no way I could know the answers beforehand from either prior work or study, you know. But yeah, I do really value the opportunity. I think about each time I speak to these people is like, if I only get to speak to them once in my life, that's why I put in so much preparation. Like I don't want to lose anything or you know, it's like that lose yourself, that Eminem thing, you know, it's like, this is my one shot to talk to someone and I want to make the most of it. And that's why I don't bring a lot of guests back. Cause I think I you know, I try to exhaust the subject or, you know, and I really try to feature the guest and put the spotlight on them. But some of the greatest takeaways, I guess, it's some of the greatest moments when the guests speak directly to me, and not necessarily to the audience. And I feel like those have been some of the deeper life lessons. I'm like, oh, they're actually saying this directly to me. You know, I think like maybe you know, during the Michael Saylor conversation, I think I asked like 3 questions. We spoke for like 2.5 hours, and at one point, you know, like I'm just like drinking a beer. And he's talking about, you know, just the news and how the news has gotten way more since the Twitter, and you know how like hurricanes, like it used to, you know, hurricanes every day in Florida during hurricane season or whatever. But now like you hear about it nonstop because of things like Twitter and social media and Facebook and people like, oh, the hurricane's coming. And he's like, it's kind of like if you were just putting toxins down your body every day, all day. And I'm like, oh my God, he's talking to me like about the beer, like. You know, and he's making a point of at me, you know, but and maybe he wasn't, you know, but like those are kind of interesting moments. Or like when Jimmy Song very early on talked about like the golden handcuffs of corporate work, and, you know, and I still have my corporate job. So I felt like Jimmy was really talking to me in that moment, you know, or it just feels that way. I don't know.
That's a good point. I think even though the podcasts I listen to, right, the guests or the interviewees, they are talking to the audience. Well, I am the audience. And some of those speakers, it feels like they're directly talking to me. And those have been some of the most impactful ones for me as well. And I think that there's a lot of people like that. And your show, because of who you talk to and because of the quality and just like the conversations that you have, is, I really, truly believe, like one of the highest signal content, pieces of content that somebody can check out if they want to listen to Bitcoin. Kind of really doesn't matter where they're at on their journey, whether they're beginners or they're more advanced. So I think that we talked a little bit earlier about, you know, were you trying to orange pill your coworkers and your family members? And it's like, well, maybe that wasn't very successful, but what you're doing now, I think, is extremely successful. I think a lot of people are getting a lot of value out of it.
I appreciate that. That means a lot to me. I just thought the show was a recreation in a lot of ways of my own journey. So like you think about like a rapper, you know, usually their first album is their best album, because if they're 20 years old, they had 20 years to kind of come up with the material for that album. And the next album, they had like 6 months to come up with the material for that one in the spotlight. So like the first 50 shows were like, those were my shows that like made such an impact on me that I, in a way, like recreated. And by recreating those shows, I kind of found my own voice, right? And it's sort of like how it takes a while for a stand-up comedian to like find their own voice. They're emulating like their favorite comedians or what they think they would sound like if they emulated their favorite comedians. It was interesting the way I thought my show would sound based on what I thought I was putting into the ingredient list and how it came out a very different way and what it is. One of the things that's been very interesting on the show is going from that, like in the beginning where guests show up and like, you know, and I think about, I use the Joe Rogan example. So if Joe Rogan's talking to a guest and he's like, oh, when you were on set, that happened. He's like, when I was on set, David Spade did this. And it's exciting and interesting because Joe's famous and the person he's interacting with is famous. So like the first time I was talking to like people on the show very early on, like they'd be like, I'm in Seattle. And I'd be like, well, I was in Seattle once. And they'd be like,
Nice.
Like, just like, you know, and now like people actually like they come on the show and like they've heard the show maybe, or like they're like, oh, and like they say nice. So it's like a very different experience going from like, you know, like early on people like would get phone calls during the show and like I'd be doing my best to get the best out of them. And I really appreciate what you say, because I really do try to make the show that has like the most signal and the most packed amount of time. You know, and I think a lot of people are putting out great shows in different areas and different rabbit holes and different niches, different voices. But if you're looking for those like philosophical conversations around Bitcoin, I'm like trying to get that, like, you know, the best out of this guest, or like the best, you know, I won't get into all what I do or how I prep unless you want to, but like, yeah, I'm trying to like get those ideas crystallized and really hit home and like be the shows that like I wanted to hear and do want to hear like on the journey. And in a lot of ways I think about it as like a bear market show. Like what show like was going to get you through that bear market that came out of it and said, not only is like, am I still in this, but like, I want more. Not because I'm trying to get you to buy Bitcoin per se, but like, but you're grokking it and you're like, wow, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. And like, I remember those shows for me. And that's, you know, I guess a big part of my journey with the show. Yeah.
You're sinking in those roots deeper and deeper. So that when it, that volatility and that hardship comes, it's just like, get much easier to get through them.
Yeah, no, it's been amazing. And like, I've heard from some listeners, they said some nice things, but yeah, no.
Good.
I just wanted to ask a follow-up question to that. It's, do you think that there's too many voices in this space? I mean, we're all podcasters here, you know, we're...
I hear
this criticism a lot, you know.
No, I think that's crap. I think there'll only be more and more voices. The space is only going to grow and grow and grow. The way things might change, I think you might have less Bitcoin-only voices because Bitcoin will just become more ubiquitous. The way, like, you don't really have shows about the dollar. Like, you have shows about how to make money and how to make more dollars, but like, you don't have, like, shows about, like, worshiping the Federal Reserve, right? Or conferences about the Federal Reserve, right? It might be about, like, a great CD product or a money market or a stock, and those are dollar-denominated assets, right? But at some point, like, Bitcoin is just king and, like, you know, it's like kind of silly to talk about it in some ways, unless you're examining it maybe in different ways, or the technology, or the security, or the philosophy, right? But just like buy Bitcoin or something. But in terms of what you're quite saying is, like, I think we're still so early. And I think what gave me confidence is, and I saw this with the beer industry, and I really wanted to open a brewery in 2003. And every time I wanted to, I thought it was too late. And I could go through all the examples of how I lived from 2003 to now. And everywhere I went, I got proven wrong. Like, oh, it's too late in Florida. They got Cigar City. And then my favorite brewery in Sarasota opened up in Calusa. And it's too late. And then there was Goose Island and there's Sam Adams and all of it, right? And they're all getting huge. And so with Bitcoin, I think like when I joined, I was like, wow, like you already have Marty, you already have Stefan, you already have Peter. And then like as I started, it was like Jimmy Song started a show, Safety started a show, Princey started like a year before me or whatever. And like, but then like, everyone is seeking out voices that they relate to. One of the things I thought, like, okay, I could bring my perspective. I'm a family man. I'm originally from New York. I got a New York accent. Maybe that people, whatever. Like, what will people relate? But at the end of the day, too, so everyone might want to start one, and there's going to be more, but not everyone sticks with it.
Right.
So how many of those shows are still around or have come and gone? Right.
And some
so
of, like. And some evolve. You mentioned like they don't have shows about worshiping the Federal Reserve. It's just something else that's denominated in Bitcoin. Well, your show even, like you've had guests like Dave Collum and Robert Malone.
Right, it's not a Bitcoiner. Like,
it's not a Bitcoin podcast episode. It is, but it is in so many ways.
Through the lens of Bitcoin, and we're looking for truth, right? And that was the thing that I felt like, wow, through the lens of Bitcoin, I could keep going.
You can keep examining truth.
We could look at education. Excuse me. We could look at all these different things. As long as it's through this sort of this lens of like, what is real, what is fake, like what is solving problems, what is not, like what is working, what isn't, and just presenting interesting and the most compelling ideas I can find and getting the people to speak on them that have those ideas. But I think that like for some people, it's going to be like, they're going to be like, I want to listen to a woman. I want to listen to a grandpa. I want to listen to a grandma. I want to listen to someone from Mexico. I want to listen to someone from Fiji or Philippines. Like, And some of these shows are going to pop up, like what's going on in Australia and what's going on in Canada, like and what's going on in Mexico and Venezuela and El Salvador. And then there'll be security and privacy and all different permutations. And they'll be about sports, like Bitcoin and sports, or like whatever people want to do. And people will take up this mantle and they'll either like find an audience, or they'll find an audience and die out, or they'll find an audience and keep growing, you know.
Or Bitcoin and weed. I hash rate, you know?
Right. I mean, this right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then there'll be LSD and there'll be cocaine and there'll be
those
fentanyl.
Will be some crazy episodes.
You know,
cocaine
and
just keep going.
Yeah, of course. You know, and
this is the cocaine.
There'll be debate shows. Like maybe somebody wants a debate show and every week it could be like Bitcoin versus ETH, Bitcoin versus gold, Bitcoin versus whatever. And or it'll be man on the street show, or There'll be 5-minute shows, and there'll be news shows, and there'll be weekly updates. And
there's never-ending content.
Right, and it's only going to be on more. Podcasting. I mean, there'll be TV shows and radio shows, and, you know, there'll be movies.
True. There's not enough, like, how many reality TV shows are there, or how many styles
terrible.
Of beer are there, or
how many
hot sauces? Show.
Yeah, exactly, right. I mean, yeah, because
you have a good point.
Not only is like some people are like, I like this one better than that hot sauce, but this hot sauce is local, so that's why I buy it. Or I bought it when I was on vacation there, you know, and there's so many. Yeah. I think there's going to just be more and more content. And I think these people who are like, I get it. I think there's also a life cycle to a podcast listener, both as a podcast listener, maybe for the medium, and then shows. So like most people, like they fall into Bitcoin. And they generally speaking, they either like a show and a host, or they like a guest and they go guest shopping or topic shopping, right? Like, I want to set up a wallet. And then you like, you might like find a guest on Marty's show and you're like, I love Marty's show. Like this, I relate to this host, and you fall in love with the host. And I think you have about like somewhere between 9 to 18 months with that host.
Yeah.
Right. And then generally speaking, you burn out of that host, and it could be for different reasons. Like it could be the host, or it could be like, you know, now that I've explored this thing and I have my stack, like I really want to learn how to like take care of it, or I really want to start a business on Bitcoin and learn how to use Lightning, or I want to run a node. And so your interests change, and you spend 6 months at Stefan Levera's show, or on, you know, someone else's show goes deep on Lightning, where you want to do, you know, Lightning Ventures and Muzz and learn about investing in Bitcoin. The listener moves around too.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's easy to make fun of Pop, but a lot of people came in because of Pomp, right? And then they found a lot of these other podcasts, a lot more about Bitcoin.
Pomp was a great top of the funnel show.
Yeah.
Pomp's super smart. I love when Pomp talks Bitcoin because he's really articulate about it. I mean, there are very few people that can go on TV and do TV style talking about Bitcoin and kill it. And Pomp and probably Natalie Brunell are top of that.
For sure.
You know, and they're and you need mainstream. I think they are more mainstream, even though they could probably talk controversial if they wanted to. And Pomp gets controversial. They both do. But they're just so articulate, and they're doing the role that they're good at.
For sure.
You know, which is, I think, what everyone should chase in terms of. That's what I think is key, is if you're going to have any chance of producing content that's going to catch, is because you want to produce that content.
Find your voice and then know it. Know who your audience is.
Or search for your voice. Yeah. But seek out things that you enjoy and want to do. Because, like, I'll tell you, like, the show is way, so much freaking work. Way more than it takes away from my time and my family. And so it's a passion project. It's a labor of love. It's my life's work. And if I didn't love doing it, I would never have gotten through, you know. It's not every show or all the prep is always fun, or like the scheduling, you know, like that's like a job in itself, especially like when you're trying to build the show and like you have less contacts and like people give you like, I can do it at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday or 4:30 a.m. on a Sunday night or whatever. It's like you have to really sacrifice a lot to bring all that together. And then do the production and market it, or, you know, all the things that get related to it. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, you definitely got to believe in it.
And you want to do it. I mean, there's no money in podcasting.
No.
Like, unless you're the, you know, Joe Rogan or McCormack.
Right.
I mean.
Right. So. Mike, what do you got anything else?
I mean, I have, this is a great conversation, and I have tons of questions to hit, but I want to be respectful of time. And so I do want everyone, you know, to know where to find you, and
where are we sending
maybe a little
them?
Bit. Yeah,
sure. You can hear the, and I've enjoyed this immensely. I appreciate you guys bringing me on the show, and I have a little bit more time. But anywhere you listen to podcasts, you can find the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. Subscribe to the channel on YouTube, on Twitter. You can find me at Ced Youngelman, CedYoungelman, and the show at _ Bitcoin Matrix, BitcoinMatrix. And Fountain, we're on Fountain as well, so you can stream it for sats there. Super appreciated.
We'll definitely need to do this one again. We'll need to run it back and get you back on the show. Everything you just mentioned will be in the show notes, but can't recommend the Bitcoin Matrix podcast more. So if you like high hash rate, I think you're going to like Bitcoin Matrix. So make sure
you're
check
gonna
that out.
Love.
There you go.
If you like high hash rate, you're going to love Bitcoin Matrix.
This has been so dope, guys.
Cool. I'll cut it. Thank you again for listening to the High Hash Rate podcast with Dan and Mike. If you want to learn more about the podcast and see what we're up to, you can find us at highhashrate.com. Or if you just want to speak to a couple of baked 80 IQ plebs, reach out to us at hello@highhashrate.com. Or you can reach out to us at the High Hash Rate handle on X. Later, everybody.
Holy Toledo!